Hi guys, I'm here with Brooks Agnew. He's like a renaissance man. He has his own TV or radio show called America Free, and he's written a bunch of books. He's a scientist, he's an explorer, he's a, I don't know, like he has patents, inventor, would you say then? Like he's a renaissance man. He's done all kinds of stuff. So welcome aboard, Mr. Brooks.
Thank you so much, Nikki. Good to be here. I'm so glad you invited me.
Okay, so what, like, I really want to get into the meat of today is Brooks is got some really good information about inner Earth or hollow Earth theory, as it were. Okay, so first, let's start this off by are you still planning? But how far are you on your Arctic expedition kind of mission project?
Well, we have done a lot. We've sent team members to the Antarctic. We've been, to China, Japan, Egypt, Canada, just about everywhere where there's a hollow Earth story. We have gone, shot film, collected the information. And the only thing left now is to go above the Arctic Circle and see if we can find that opening through the crust.
Okay, so your plan... Last I heard, your plan was to kind of film it in the process too, and to
we were gonna stream live from the ship. And there's only one ship that can make this trip, and that is a nuclear powered icebreaker that is run by Russia. So right now you can't buy Russian dressing, let alone rent a Russian ship. So it's kind of on hold, but we're still working toward it. We still have a good team. We have plenty of planetary awareness of our expedition, and so we're working toward it.
Okay, so what's the first thing that hooked you into there might be a hollow Earth?
That is a great question. We were actually, my late co-author and I were writing a series of books called The Ark of Millions of Years. So we were doing our research for the first volume, which was published in 2004. And while I was doing my research, someone handed me a book called Our Hollow Earth, and I read it. I found it entertaining. I put it on the shelf, didn't think about it again. But as we were researching the 44 ancient cultures that we used to write the nonfiction four-book series, we ran across a lot of ancient information about how these epic communities believed that there was some life force, some life almost beings that came from the inner Earth. And so I picked up the book again and I read it again, and there was a few outlandish claims in it. So I said, well, let's treat it like science. Let's have a hypothesis that Earth is a molten ball floating through space, and we live on tectonic plates floating around like cornflakes in a bowl of milk. Let's try to prove that. And as the evidence began coming in, and we used space-based evidence, geological evidence, oceanographic evidence, we couldn't prove it. We couldn't prove that we live on a molten ball. Everything seemed to lean toward the prospect that we have some space between our core and our crust. And you would be very surprised at some of the evidence that we gathered. And it just led us to keep going on it, to try to see if we can find that opening between the two oceans.
See, it's like, I think you're in some ways way more scientific to me, because I'm into the woo too. Like I think I really seriously got bounced into, I started looking into it in 2018, 2019, just a little bit, because for me, what really, the fact that there's like 25,000 miles circumference of the Earth, and we've only dug in like what, 14 miles or something, or I mean like the deepest, like
way less than that. We've only dug in like 40,000 feet, so 8 miles barely.
I mean, but then you have like Mariana Trench, the furthest hole that there is that we know of. It's 0.00% percentage of the planet that we've actually dug into.
Well, the woo is really what kind of led me to it, because, you know, we're talking about Babylonians and Olmecs and Mayans and American Indians, and even, you know, the ancient, tribes of Israel talked about the Lost Ten Tribes coming out of the north on a highway of ice out of the inner earth. And when I was in Egypt doing research, I hooked up with Hani Elzaini, who had the manuscript. It was written by Om Seti in by hand, her hand translations.
The one who found the Osirian?
Yeah, it was the work around Abydos. It was never published, but I got to read it at his apartment. And I ran across a place where she had translated that the people escaped a kind of cataclysm, and they escaped, it said, into the inner earth. So I thought, well, it could be caves, but, you know, you would say caves, not inner earth. And so it kind of led us one way and then the other. And then I think it was around 2005, they took a long range picture of Earth from space. And what they noticed were Borealis over both poles at the same time. And this went counter to everything that we knew about the sun's interaction with the Earth. We kind of felt like, you know, in our winter time, when our North Pole is, you know, facing away from the sun, that we get this aurora based on the solar wind.
Right, because it was supposed to be solar, yeah, just solar winds like coming in. Right. That would only hit at one, if we're at 23 degrees axis, it would only hit when you were tilted towards the sun, not when the bottom is away from the sun.
Yeah. So in 2006, my good buddies down at JPL, they put together a project called the Themis Project, Themis. And it was basically a nose cone with five satellites in it. And they hurried it up and they launched it. And these five satellites went into low Earth orbit as kind of a Jacob's ladder, different altitudes of orbits. And when they lined up, like Jacob's ladder going out into space, they turned the project on. And what they were measuring was energy, you know, that was existent in the low Earth orbit and relative to the aurora, which the aurora was kind of quiet at the moment. And all of a sudden, between satellites 3 and 4, what they described as a cosmic bullet just exploded, like out of an interdimensional explosion of energy. And the shock wave of energy went past, you know, satellites 3 and 4 and went out into space, and then past the other satellites and headed for Earth. And when it reached the atmosphere, the aurora appeared. So they said, oh, that's it. The auroras are caused by cosmic bullets. And they turned the project off. And that was the end of that space program.
Yeah. And I'm like, what does cosmic bullets mean?
Even? Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. So but the fact that they spent, you know, $75 million to launch these satellites to try to test where the aurora came from alerted me, hey, there's something else here. So we started pulling other evidence together. And then Dr. Y Sessions at Washington University published a paper. His students, his geology students, went over 600,000 seismograms. These are printouts that are made from earthquakes. When earthquakes occur, it's not just the listening station that's close to the earthquake. Listening stations all over the earth pick up these vibrations as they pass through the planet. And so when you put a whole bunch of scans together, it's like doing a CAT scan of Earth. You get an image of what the Earth looks like. Mm-hmm. And the remarkable thing was he published that they discovered another ocean the size of the Arctic Ocean underneath the Atlantic Ocean, underneath the crust. They could actually see the waves crashing on shore inside the planet. And so I thought, well, that's pretty remarkable too. So that sand went in the balance, and slowly this balance began to tilt, you know, toward, hey, maybe we do live on a hollow sphere. And then the Japanese did a spectrographic measurement of the core of the Earth because they wanted to find out what it was made of. And we, in chemistry and in inorganic chemistry or inorganic chemistry, we know the frequency of every element in the periodic chart. We know the frequency that they put off and at different temperatures. And so what they measured the core as was an iron crystal, a solid iron crystal, except there were two humps on it. And of course, the only way this could line up is under great pressure and great temperature. So what they tried to do is duplicate it. And Carnegie science put together an experiment to try to duplicate those conditions in the lab. So they created a diamond anvil, which was about this big, and then they cut it in two. So they had two halves of it. Mm-hmm. And then they put hydraulic rams on either side of the diamond and a crucible in between them. So they put iron filings in the crucible, and then they smashed it to the same pressure that they imagined the inner earth was at. And then they shot a laser through the diamond to heat up the crucible. And when they got to just about 6,000 degrees C, which happens to be the surface of the sun, they got the peaks to line up. So they knew that the core was made of this iron crystal, but they couldn't figure out what the second hump was. And then they decided to experiment with infusing different gases into the iron. And when they got to xenon, it lined up perfectly. And this answered an old question that we've had in oceanography for a long, long time. And that is, in chemistry, we have this law called the law of partial pressures. It's sort of like, you know, in this bottle of Perrier, there's a little bit of headspace above this liquid. If we were to take a needle and take a sample of this space, mm-hmm. it would equal proportionally the chemicals in the Perrier, right? Well, when we do that, xenon's missing from our atmosphere. A lot of it, like 90% of the xenon's missing from our atmosphere. We don't know where it is. We never have known until this experiment. Now we know that the xenon of the earth is actually locked in that iron crystal, and that matches the second hump. So it answered two questions in one, and it certified that our crust is somewhere around 17 or 18 grams per cubic centimeter, which is very dense, and it is rotating faster than the crust. That's what generates our magnetosphere. We have a very thick crust, about 900 miles thick. And then we have this core, which is about 1400 miles in diameter, and it's rotating faster than the crust. So the counter rotation between the two is what's making the magnetic field around the earth. All okay. these questions started to fall into place. So then in 2018, We had a very warm year. It was like global warming warm. And a big piece of Arctic ice broke off.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. It was like as big as like Massachusetts or something.
Yeah, it was a state-sized piece. And it really opened the Northwest Passage for the first time in, I don't know, maybe 2,000 years, maybe longer. It was navigable. But the interesting thing was the following summer, the Scripps Institute went to Malaysia, and every so often they do a sample of rays in the ocean, like stingrays, manta rays. Turns out they're kind of like the tree frogs of the ocean. Like if you go to Amazon and you sample tree frogs, they are very sensitive to environmental toxins and changes, and the tree frogs mutate, you know, a lot. Sometimes they have six legs and, you know, just all kinds of weird anomalies. And rays do that thing, same thing in the ocean. Normally, they find about 40 or 50 unique species of rays when they do this sample, except that summer, 1,500 different species of rays. And they netted frilled sharks and dorsal squids, which have not been on this planet for at least a million years. So it was evident that maybe this, when the Northwest Passage opened, it allowed these inner Earth creatures to swim through an opening between the oceans, get into the Gulf Stream, and make their way to Malaysia where they were netted. So these things just piqued our curiosity even more. And it helped us kind of zero in on a 10,000 square mile square where we think that opening is in the Arctic Ocean. Of course, it's 4,000 meters deep, which is a little deeper than you can dive or send any kind of craft down, but mm-hmm. it's doable. We can develop technology to sample that bottom. So we're excited about it.
So that would be the goal, right? So you would get to the Arctic Circle and then
to survey this area.
Drones we have about underneath the ocean and try to figure out
15 days to sail back and forth. We have some samplers that we can drop onto the bottom, inflate a nitrogen bag, and then they will float back to the surface. We'll take the core out of them, reload them, drop them again. and we can take samples off the bottom. We don't think that there's an opening that you can sail a boat into, but there may be an opening in the crust. And if we can find that opening, or even a high concentration of fossilized sea life around an area, that's going to be life-changing for everybody.
So like, let's talk about the openings too, because like, if you look at all the other planets like Jupiter or like Saturn, like they all have those like hexagonal circles at the bottom of their poles. So I mean, it's not like it would be like the weirdest thing in the world if we had holes at our poles. And then also they all make a noise. Like I listen to, sometimes when I'm meditating, I particularly like the sound of Jupiter. Like I listen to like they have like the sounds of the planets that they make whenever they put certain, whenever NASA was recording certain flybys or whatever. And that's something, if it has its own signature noise, every planet, then that's kind of not, that would go to and Earth has a Schumann resonance or whatever. We have our own noise too. So it's just one of those things where I think if you were completely solid, that would be a lot less of a noise than.
Yeah. We're pretty sure that, we can look out into space and we can see planets in various stages of development. We can see giant gas clouds. We can see what we call accretion disks, which is where these clouds begin to coalesce. And as they do, they begin to spin. And we think, because we haven't been looking at space for that long, but we think what happens is these gas clouds begin to form little eddy currents and they form planets. And then the center forms a star. And that's how solar systems are born. It's a big speculation, because we also see examples of these gas clouds having huge electrical sparks, like lightning that goes, almost interplanetary lightning. And when the lightning goes coursing through this cloud, it forms planets, it forms stars. So we're thinking that there's an electromagnetic method of making planets and making stars. However, we see these planets in two other states. One is when they begin to collapse or coalesce, they begin spinning faster and faster and faster and faster, like an ice skater, you know, pulling her arms in. And they do one of two things. They either get lopsided and they spin off a piece of themselves, like a moon, or like we believe that Mercury was once part of Venus. It can actually spit off a large piece of itself that can become another planet orbiting that sun, or they explode, like, you know, like our asteroid belt maybe, or they just expand and cool and expand and cool and expand and cool. And we look at our Earth, we go down in deep in the ocean, like the trench you were talking about, the Mariana Trench, and we can see the crust of the Earth still cracking open and filling in with molten material and cracking open and filling it. Now it's slower now, but it is, the Earth is still expanding, which means it probably left the core behind. The crust began to expand and the core stayed solid on the inside, which means there's space between the core and the crust.
So your guesstimation, like about how much space do you think, like if you had to put money on it, about how much stuff would you say, how much available space is there inside the Earth?
You have no idea how excellent that question is, because I've always speculated that planets are about, you know, 1 gram per cubic centimeter, about like water. And so we look at a planet's size and we guess its weight. But a better way to guess it is how long it takes to go around the sun and how far away it is from the sun. We can calculate the weight pretty darn close. The other way is we measure the distance from the sun to the Earth. And we have these areas we call Lagrange points. They're points of equidistance between bodies that are orbiting around one another. And we can measure it to within like a meter, very, very close. And the odd thing about the distance between the Earth and the sun is it's off by several kilometers, like 15 kilometers. That's a long distance, which means the Earth is heavier than what it appears by its diameter, which means the core is heavy and the crust is expanded. And so that's what sets our orbit around the sun. And it means that there's space. We think that the crust is about 12 to 1400 miles in diameter. The crust is about 900 miles thick. It's about 7,300 miles in diameter. So that leaves about 1,200 miles between the crust and the core of space that's filled with air.
So how, like, you know, I'm into a bunch of the legends too, like Shambhala and, well, I mean, the amount of legends I could go on about, like all this stuff with the inner earth stuff, but I kind of don't understand how they're like, if there really is a civilization that lives inside the earth at different places, whatever, like, are they all connected? Are there just little pockets, and, or how do they actually develop oxygen? Or maybe they don't need oxygen. Maybe they breathe something else. Like, how does that system work? Like, I don't understand how.
Well, it is going to work a little different than the surface does, because we're exposed to solar radiation.
Yeah.
However,
and we'd have different gravity, right?
Yes, different gravity. It'll be lighter, of course. But our atmosphere is actually only about, what?
20 miles thick.
Yeah, 20 miles. That's about it. We're talking 1,200 miles.
And you can't breathe after, what, like 10,000 feet? You start having problems and you can't breathe after 16,000
feet. I've been to 18,500 feet. I can still breathe. And we were going to 23,000, but we had 11 people on our crew and several of them got edema, so we couldn't go the rest of the way. But I would have gone. And there's base camp is at 23,500. So it's way up there, let me tell you.
Yeah.
At 19,000 feet, you walk and then breathe, and then you walk and then you breathe. And it took me days and days and days to acclimate, believe me. And I was in good shape when I went. So yeah, it's once you get up so high, you need oxygen or you'll die in this, on our planet. But down there, it's below sea level. So it's going to be a very dense kind of atmosphere. But I can tell you this, yes, it might be, you know, extreme, but if the core is at 6,000 degrees C, and then you have an atmosphere full of moisture, and it's 1,200 miles of insulation, and then you get to a crust that has liquid water, by the way, on the inside of it, not steam, but liquid water, which means it's less than 212 degrees, you got extremophores that can live in that environment. Like I said, they netted rays and frilled sharks and dorsal squids, and these were not extremophores. These were living in an ocean. So I can tell you, if there is space there, there will be life. I can tell you that.
It's interesting because I always wonder, it's like, what if their sky is an ocean? Like, you know, what if...
Well, yeah, it's a land with no horizon, that's for sure.
It would be really weird in there. Something is up with the center of the earth.
By the way, I'm glad you're an earth explorer. This is good. I've been to Tibet myself, across the Tibetan Plateau, and it is interesting. And I got down in the basement of the Patala and saw a stupa and saw the Milky Way galaxy all over the floor with a big turquoise rock in the middle of it. It was built in the 7th century, so these people were very well connected. But I'm in Hawaii and I'm speaking at a conference. And I'm out at the desk and I'm selling my books. And this woman comes up to me and she says, I have a message for you. Do you have a piece of paper? I said, well, yeah, sure. So I gave her my lab notebook and opened to a blank page and gave her a pen. And she started to draw. And she said, okay, this is a story of 8 whale brothers that came to me. And they said that I'm to come to you and tell you that they are going to invite you into the inner earth and that they're here at Hawaii to meet you and to make sure that, you know, to acknowledge you so that you can find the portal to the inner earth. I'm a scientist and I believe that facts are direct observations. I'm much more into corroborated facts, but I still record them and take them at their face value. So the next day we're going to go swimming with the dolphins and we're going to take 2 boats. They're pretty fast, I guess, 30, 35 miles an hour. They're pretty good sized boats. Our crowd divides up into 2. And as I'm getting on the boat, I ask the boat captain, are we going to, you know, see any whales today? And he said, no, I don't think so. I think all the whales have gone north. You know, we're just going to go out to the North Shore and swim with the dolphins. I said, oh, okay. Well, that's cool. So the two boats take off and we're both firewalled and the other boat's pulling away from us. It gets out, I guess, maybe 3/8 of a mile ahead of us. And off to the right of our boat, all of a sudden, there's this whale blow. So the law is that the boat, both boats have to come to an idle and they have to let the whales pass. Now, the whales are probably 2,500 feet from our boat, but they turn and they head straight for our boat. So I'm rolling film this whole time as they're coming toward us. And they got like zeroed in on us. They passed by the other boat and they came, we're coming straight for us. So I went to the bow of the boat and I leaned over the rail so I could just look down right on the water. And those eight whales swam right in front of the boat one by one. And then they turned and went north and, you know, freed us up so we go the rest of our way.
They came just to see you.
There was not a dry eye on this boat. I mean, the feeling was just like holy almost. It was unbelievable that the spirit on that boat at that time. And I wrote it down. It's all in my lab notebook and that's the best witness that I have. But so we both have similar stories. Kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great story. That's awesome. I think the ocean is deeply connected to the inner earth as well. And I mean, you know, it's like, I almost sometimes wonder if like the mermaid legend isn't related to inner earth beings too, you know, cause that might end up, but I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I grew up with the Isleta tribe and I'm from a town south of Albuquerque and it was shared elementaries, whatever. There was no elementary school at the reservation. So they went to school with us. And on Fridays, they would have like an elder come and give us stories, like ever since I was in kindergarten until I was like fourth grade.
Cool.
And one of their stories is, and I mean, that was for the native kids, but we got to benefit too. One of their stories was, they really did tell the ant people story about how they came and they take them into the Grand Canyon before everything was flooded. And then they had another flood story where this one guy goes up to the top of the highest peak in the Rocky Mountains and like sat in water around his ankles for 40 days until all the water receded. And then he came back down. They were about coming up from the earth.
Mm-hmm.
They have certain spirits that come up from the, like kachinas come when they go into a kiva, like a kachina comes up from the ground and gives them information and then goes back into the ground. They still claim to have convergence with the star people, but the star people come from inside the earth. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, then this kind of crosses with the UFO community too, because there's a lot of evidence that UFOs exist. I'm convinced they exist. I've taken pictures of them during the daytime up at Washington State.
Yeah, I've seen UFOs. And,
you know, everybody's convinced that they exist, but lots of speculation about, you know, where they actually go when they're done flying around teasing us. Because I think they're as real as they want to be. And if they wanted to be more real, there's really not much we could do about it. And I'm so happy they haven't brandished their weapons yet, but they must go someplace. And so my speculation is maybe they live on the bottom of the ocean, because we don't know much about the bottom of the ocean. Shipping ways, yeah, but the rest of it, no. And maybe there are places inside the planet that they go. Maybe they're much older than us and they've been here for millions of years instead of thousands of years like we have on the surface. And maybe our surface has become corrupted and they can't live here anymore. So they come visit us.
You would think if you were going to inhabit a place, the place that would be safest would be inside of something, not, you know.
Most of the planets we look at, you can't live on the surface. You have to live inside. Even the moon. I mean, we could build a moon base, and I'm a big proponent for that, but not on the surface. The solar radiation would destroy us. but there are lots of volcanic vents inside the moon, big enough to hold cities the size of Philadelphia, easy. And they could be sealed up and pressurized, and you could live inside the moon easily, but not on the surface. We're lucky to be able to live on the surface of this spaceship we call Earth.
Well, and we have fossil evidence that will show you that there's been many a catastrophe before, and there'll be, you know, perhaps again. So, so that it is way more stable if you could live on the Earth. Have you also heard of like the ills? Like ills go, all ills, they go in and out of, they don't really know where they spawn from, except that they spawn from somewhere in the Bermuda Triangle, but they eat them, their bodies alive, and get back to go spawn. And then when the little babies come out of somewhere around the Bermuda Triangle, they go back to wherever their parent had, all over like North America and Europe, and they go crazy distances to go live, and then they come back there to spawn. But we can't even figure out where their spawning place is, you know.
There's the Ross Gull, because one of my ancestors is Sir James Ross. The Ross and Agnew clans were very tight back in the 1400s and 1200s. And in 1831, my ancestor, Sir James Ross, discovered the North Magnetic Pole. And one of his discoveries is now called the Ross Gull. It's just a little seagull. And most birds fly south for the winter to nest and, you know, all that stuff. Not the Ross Gull. It flies north. And I talked to the world's leading ornithologist who lives in Scotland, and they still to this day do not know where the Ross Gull goes. They know it flies north, it migrates north, but this bird's not like a penguin. I mean, it's not got a lot of body fat. There's no way it could take 70 below zero for 3 months. It has to go someplace warm to nest, and they just don't know where it goes.
Yeah, that's it. Like, and I heard you say on your Arctic expedition, you guys actually plan to find that out. Like, that's one of the missions.
That would be, they've tried lots of things. This little bird can't really carry a radio, you know, and you can't track a radio except by line of sight. And maybe you could put a satellite transponder on it, but they're just haven't done it. They just have not tracked where these birds go. So. I know Sir James Ross, he lost his first ship and part of his crew the first time he went up because got caught in the Arctic ice. The ice smashed his ship. So they offloaded all the supplies and wintered on this ice floe. And then the next spring they rescued him. And then the darn fool raised the money and did it again. And this time he did find the North Magnetic Pole. So that's why he's in the encyclopedia.
So, and to clarify for people, I mean, because I... like today when I told my mom I was having you on, and I was explaining who you were, and she was like, well, we've explored the North Pole. There's tons of people who have been to the North Pole. Like,
yeah, the North Pole. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. So explain how unexplored this place is, because even you have like Admiral Byrd, you have there's been four or five people who've done missions, but they're kind of, but can you explain how obscure this place is?
Yeah. When you're talking about, you know, 0 degrees north, you're talking about the North Pole. That's done every year. One way or another, they go to the North Pole. But the Arctic is a continent-sized piece of ice. And it thaws out in the summertime, pretty much, and then it refreezes in the wintertime. And in 2008, 2009, it got very small. And up there, we call it red ice. Red ice is the ice that exists through the summer and then gets snowed on the next year. The red ice actually got very small, but by 2018, it was right back to where it always is, and it's very thick. It's like 3 yards thick, so it's substantial, the red ice. Hmm. So, but you can't, like, you know, get the Huskies and go across it, because it's all cut up. It's all, the wind just pushes up mountains of ice, you know, a couple hundred feet high and big cracks, and you can't go across this ice. It's extremely treacherous. The only way to get through it is with an icebreaker, and the only icebreakers on Earth that can make this trek are in Murmansk, Russia. They're huge nuclear powered icebreakers, and they're 450 feet long, 75,000 horsepower, and they have a 3.5 year fuel supply. They're the only ones that can break through the ice and make it, but they've never explored this particular area that we're talking about. This 10,000 square foot area is just not in the shipping lanes at all.
And I also heard you talk about the NOAA, like the Law Data Denial Act of 2006, and how you can't view above the 60th parallel. So is that still in place? And what's that about?
You can't go to Google Earth, you know, and like look at the North Pole. Everything above the 60th parallel that you can look at online is all animated. Okay. It isn't real. It's just computer graphics. The reason they do this is because accurate satellite data above the 60th parallel can be fed into cruise missiles and be used for targeting. So that's why they don't make the data available.
What about Antarctica?
Well, the Antarctic's actually a continent. It's actually land, mountains and plains and everything, and it has ice on it. So it was 2018, Brad Olson, who's on our team, went to Antarctica the hard way. He went way down to Argentina and got a boat and they sailed to Antarctica. It took him 3 days to get there. And he thought he was going to die every minute of those 3 days because the ocean was so rough. I asked him, you know, so was there a wave that hit the boat that you kind of thought, you know, this is it. This boat's going to smash to pieces and we're going to die out here and no one's going to know about it. And he said, every wave that hit that boat, but they made it. And because they were Americans, they were able to go to the American bases that were down there. And this was right before wintertime in South America or in the Antarctic. So they could stay for about 5 or 6 days. And he said it got up to about 50 degrees. And, you know, they asked all the questions that they wanted of the people around the base about any openings in the inner earth, any UFOs that were discovered, any, you know, weird kind of, and there was none of that. But they didn't explore the entire Antarctica. They only went two bases down there. So they didn't get a whole lot of information. Now,
I have a friend who just got back from, and it was like a $15,000 cruise.
Yeah, it's down expensive. There.
Super expensive, yeah. And I got some rocks, so that's cool.
Yeah, and you don't go off the trail. I mean, they
yeah, exactly. And that's what he said. He was just like, it's very, you know, like, it's like when I went to NASA when I was in the eighth grade, I remember being like, wow, this is so crap. Because it was like, it'd be like, you're in a little trolley, and it'd be like, and that is the building that we keep the moon rocks in. And that is the building that you're going, oh, really? Is it? I can just point to random buildings and tell you things of wonder that happened in the tomb. Do I get to go see it? Can I get out and go do something in it? No, then thank you for telling me fantastical stories about random buildings. You know, I guess
it's Smithsonian say, look, I want to see where you store the UFOs. Where's that?
Or the giant bones or the whatever.
Or the giant bones, good luck.
Okay, so you don't think that Admiral Byrd's diary, you think that's kind of fan fiction?
We did a philological analysis of the language used in the diary and all the other writings of Admiral Byrd and his TV appearances, which he had many, and the language is different. Whoever wrote that diary, it is fake as fake can be. Okay. And I've held it in my hands. It's just fantastic, but it's not true.
Fantastic. Okay. What about the Smoky God?
I've read the Smoky God too. Interesting story about the, you know, sailing in one pole and coming out the other. And I've also read Etta Dorfa, which is Aphrodite spelled backwards. So we went to Mammoth Cave numerous times and finally got up with the oldest guide there for the caves. And I've been in every cave at Mammoth Cave. And when I was down there with him, we got into some pretty squeezy places, let me tell you. I asked him, what's the deepest part of this cave that's ever been explored by anything? He said 360 feet. That's not an opening to the inner earth. And then I got to thinking about it. You know, if you walked 900 miles through the crust to the inner earth, you would die. you could not carry enough food and water for that trip. You just could not make it. It's not possible. So it's a great story. As I said, these are direct observations. I take them as their face value, but they're uncorroborated.
Okay, so what do you think about Shambhala, Agartha, and the like the Dalai Lama's connection as the guard in between the two?
I've been to the Dalai Lama's house. In fact, I've been to it more times than he has in his later life. And I've been all over Tibet, and I asked all kinds of monks, and they told me about Shambhala. We were in the upper plateau in the dry season, so there's not a lot of flooded rivers and stuff like that. Fantastic, fantastic how advanced this civilization was. I mean, actually beat the Chinese in a war way back then, so they were a significant people. But I was not able to substantiate any opening into the inner earth. Holy places, yes. Fantastic places with resonance like unbelievable, like trees, tree trunks that they cut down and built temples with. And there are no trees within 200 miles of anywhere close to that. Nothing like that. So it's, yes, there are fantastic stories, but the monks don't really believe that. And I spent some time with the monks too, both female and male, and they just don't have any more information about that.
Yeah, that's it. That's good to know. That's pretty interesting. So then what's the thing that's driving you though about it though? What's the story
it's this missing piece, you know. I've got 20 years of exploration, and you know, I'm a scientist, so I like to find answers. And it's just, you know, in 2006 when I joined the expedition, it was actually led by a man named Stephen Curry at the time, and he developed rapid onset brain cancer and died that winter. So I thought, well, that's it, you know, the expedition's over. And then they called me later that year, and the board called me and said, hey, how would you like to head up the expedition? I said, I don't know anything about it, but I do big projects all the time, so I'll try it. And we were actually going to go in 2008. We had a fair amount of money raised. We had almost the deposit ready for the ship. We had already made arrangements with the shipping company, and the economy decided to do something else that year. And that was the end of that. This is about a $3.5 million expedition. So I just don't have that laying around.
Right.
And there is no like magic fundraiser that you can do to raise that much money. There are certain things you have to do. One of them, of course, is a GoFundMe or a Give, Send, Go. But even a small campaign on those venues costs $60,000. So we're in the process of raising that $60,000 to raise the first $1.5 million to get us the deposit.
To have a conference about inner earth or all these things, or like polls, because.
Well, I've spoken all over the world. And of course, I've been on History Channel and Discovery Channel and Nat Geo Channel. And believe me, there are more enthusiasts about the inner earth than are about Middle Earth. I mean, it's just incredible the interest people have in this project. All we really need to do is reach them. Now, we produced a film in 2007, and we entered it into the Genes of Galileo contest in Tokyo, and we won the Genes of Galileo contest. 17.5 million people saw our film in one night.
Nice.
We generated a lot of interest, and all we really need to do is get a dollar from each one of those people, and we're home free. We've got this expedition done and ready to produce for people to see it. What we want to do is we have satellite access. We want to put cameras on the ship 24 hours a day and stream it live, so everybody in the world can go with us. The boat can only hold 125 passengers, but we want everybody in the world to see what we see the same time we see it.
That would be really great. And are you, and so you, right now you guys are kind of at a standstill with the renting of the boat and then raising the funds. So you guys, you have your team, you just don't have all of the pieces together.
We're steadily raising the money. We're ready to do the first part of the GoFundMe. It takes about 30 grand to do the first wave and then 30 grand to do the second one. We're ready to do that. But, you know, we talked to the Polar Science Foundation, which is does give out small grants, but they also want all the data. But they are not very interested in anything Russian, not for a while.
Yeah. And I would imagine, okay, well, so then this is where I get a little bit conspiratorial, but yeah, like, do you think that like there is maybe a concerted effort to make this kind of research not happen?
No, I think they think we're crazy. So they don't think we'll ever get it done.
Yeah, well, like, yeah, I could see that. That they don't think that it'll get done. But I mean, it is weird that we're talking about going and building stuff on Mars and we haven't even explored our own planet that we're
on. Oh my gosh, I've had so many discussions with that. I wrote a book called Asteroid Mining, The Future of Energy. And I'm telling you, the cislunar space is already being developed. There are several things we still have to do yet. Artemis hasn't launched. I don't even know if it's going to launch this year. And I mean, what we have to do is develop the space between Earth and the moon. We have to develop GPS satellites around the moon so that we can navigate. There's no way to navigate the moon. What we do now to go around the moon is we use the GPS satellites of Earth to guide us. That's what the Indians did. And of course, they splatted into the moon with their rover. The Chinese made it, but you basically have to fly it to the ground with a joystick. You can't program it to do it because the gravitational field around the moon is very anomalous. The moon is not equal density all the way. It's got a very heavy side because of all the asteroid impacts that it's had over the millions of years. And the heavy side faces us all the time. It's locked into us. So you can't just, you know, orbit around the moon using a time and then land on the moon because your acceleration is going to change. You have to fly it, you know, either with a joystick from Earth or have a pilot in it to land it. So, and the guys, you know, at SpaceX and me and others were saying we need to develop a lunar base first.
I think so too. I've always said that. I'm like, why would you go to Mars before you go to at least the moon?
Yeah. And the LCROSS mission, which discovered the Shackelford crater, which is in the Schrodinger's basin, which is on the south pole of the moon. It was an experiment that was shall we say, a backup plan, because the ship that we sent was actually a very advanced spectrometer, and it developed a fuel leak, and all the fuel leaked out, so it could not go around the moon anymore. So it was evident that the orbit was going to decay, it was going to crash into the moon. So what they did is they blew the bolts, which separated the ship into two pieces. And the front part, which was the engine and all the heavy parts of the ship, it went ahead and landed. It hit the moon going about Mach 7. And when it did, it left a big hole and put a big plume of dust and everything in the air. And the spectrometer flew through that dust and sampled it all, took the readings, broadcast it to Earth, and then it smashed into the moon. But what we discovered was that crater is full of frozen helium-3. That's a huge discovery, because here's this Mount Everest-sized crater, upside down, of course, of frozen helium-3, which is fuel. We have helium-3 on Earth, but only around volcanoes. Most of the helium on Earth is helium-4, which we use to, you know, fill our party balloons. Helium-3 is unique in the sense it's light, a neutron. And if you fuse it together, it forms helium-4 plus two energetic protons. It also produces a tremendous amount of energy. So that fusion could be used to power Earth for 10,000 years. It's extremely valuable.
That's really interesting too, because like I didn't realize there was a difference in the heliums. And I also know that once helium escapes our atmosphere, like you can't get it's when it escapes, it's gone. So
that's right.
I feel like
solar
really
wind blows it away.
And it's super weird that we use it for party balloons. Like when I like it may end up being super valuable one day, and we were just like, hey, what up?
Well, if we go to the moon and we develop that base and we use that fuel to power a moon colony, which could take 50, 60, 75 years to develop, now you have fusion rocketry, which brings the Mars much more feasible instead of taking 7 months to 2 years to get there.
Yeah, I mean, most of your fuel is the trajectory out of the atmosphere. Once you break that barrier, you mean...
Yeah. And, you know, our fuel is either methane, which is what SpaceX uses, or hydrogen peroxide, which is what NASA uses. But fusion is, you know, cuts right. the time to get to Mars to 70 days. That's doable.
Yeah, that's not bad versus whatever, how like 9 month mission or something. Or,
well, yeah, plus you have artificial gravity going all the way there. And it's not centrifugal gravity. It's linear gravity.
But see, these are all also going to points of, if you're going to try to live on other planets and like do bait, like why, I don't understand what, like, oh, there's literally 4,000 people, including tourists, that see Antarctica a year.
Yeah.
Like that, like, do you know, I mean, it's, and to your point about like the Arctic Circle, like, no, these are the perfect kind of places that people should be exploring. We should be using our technology to try to get better at being in the most inhospitable places ever, because that helps promote exploration and makes you more resilient as a species and blah, blah, blah. So you're going to go to places without atmosphere and with extreme cold, but you won't go to our extreme
cold. The Antarctic guided tour is about 15 grand. And the Arctic guided tour is about 25 grand. So not everybody could afford you know, to do that kind of exploration. But the moon is incredibly valuable because it gives us a low gravity, very high mineral rich base to launch from. And you can build, you know, several million pound ships that orbit the moon and can go into deep space, which you cannot do from Earth. You just can't do it from Earth.
Yeah. So that like, we'll see if they ever, I mean, we can have all the science fiction wonder ideas ever for them, but what they'll be like, all right, guys, let's everybody stop. Let's look, we're gonna crash something into an asteroid, right? 3, 2, 1, yay. You know, it's that, you know, whatever, I guess it's baby steps, but it's so much more baby. The amount of money we pour into it too versus the
that's the other thing about the moon is once you get there, it pays its own way. Helium-3 is so valuable that it could actually be, I mean, commercial companies could make money transporting helium-3 back to the Earth and powering our nuclear power stations for, I mean, we could power them now for about
I'm conspiracy theorist about stuff like that, because I'm going like, we haven't set a human being back on there since 1972. We had like 12 guys set foot on the moon from 69 to 72, and that's it. They were like, okay, cool, been there, done that. It's like, that just story doesn't add up.
Well, it's because Congress was running everything, and NASA is just a slush fund. That's all NASA is. But when SpaceX got involved, It dragged with it about 65 commercial companies that build all the stuff.
Right.
And they're all making money because, of course, NASA's paying for it. Of course, they're saving money and using SpaceX. SpaceX makes about $4 million profit on every launch. But when they get to the moon and start mining the moon, it's worth trillions. Tens of trillions of dollars, just what's on the moon. And if we get to Mars, one asteroid is more than all the value of everything we've produced since the Industrial Revolution.
All the money in the world. There you go.
In other words, money becomes no object at that point, because there's no need for it. There's no reason for poor people. There's no reason for people without energy. There's no reason to live along wires on the ground that the power company says you have to be hooked to.
Right. So you're just saying that there'll be so much resources available on it that it would...
It's a big difference. I mean, when you consider the way we live on Earth right now, if you go to India, there are 500 million people in India that don't have a home address. They've never received a piece of mail in their entire life. Many of them have never had a clean glass of water. That's not the way we're supposed to live on Earth.
Mm. Yeah, no, I mean, like I've been to India too. That's it's interesting. Oh yeah, and then the like what is this thing about like the pollen and there's dead bees on the ice in the Antarctic?
Yeah, that's a very odd thing. Is when you get up there, and they've explored a lot of the ice by bush plane. You can find places to land when the weather's suitable. And the odd thing about it is, oftentimes they find pollen. Like here in the South, in North Carolina, in the springtime, we get pine pollen. It coats everything. No sense washing your car because it's going to be yellow by the next morning. Well, that's what they found on the ice up there, is just miles and miles and miles of pollen on the ice. But there's not a flower or a tree for 500 miles in any direction. They don't know where the pollen's coming from. It's got to blow up out of someplace warm and land on that ice. And bees can go, what, several hundred yards?
Yeah.
Is about the distance of their hive. And yet you find dead bees on the ice. What is up with that? Of course, we're talking about someplace warm with foliage that's accessible through the ice.
Well, and then that makes me kind of feel like, you know, like there's always like the legends of like high Brazil, or, you know, like these, like there could be like floating land masses that we don't know about. You know, maybe there's like something like that going on, or but I mean, like if you're thinking that it's a hole underneath the ocean, it would be really hard for, I mean, where are the seagulls and the bees going? I mean, like that it seems like the idea of there being an open hole that you can go into would make more sense for those, for the flying things, versus like a hole at the bottom of the ocean, which that would make sense.
We've entertained a lot of ideas. This seems to be the one where we can find that crustal hole that the two oceans mix together. But we talked to the company that makes the high altitude helium balloons that, you know, high schools buy them and launch a iPhone up to 80,000 feet. And then
there's that other one, that company called A World View, which uses ginormous balloons that go into low Earth orbit with helium.
Well, they haven't done it yet. They're building one, though. I'm very interested in that because, you know what? That's not weightless. I could do that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not going up in a weightless condition because I've been weightless before. I've been in the Air Force, and it's no fun. It's like you constantly want to throw up. But that, at least you're sitting in a chair and you're looking out a window, and it's basically up and down. You don't travel.
Right. You know, it's like a hot air balloon.
But anyway, we went to the company that builds these balloons, and they're not that expensive. And we thought about building a bunch of them and launching them on the west side and letting them drift across the Arctic and gather film, and then just picking them up on the other side. And that's still doable, but it's going to take a tremendous team to be able to do it, and optimum weather conditions.
Well, and that's the other thing, because you said it's cloudy most of the time.
That's what I was going to say. They can't go any higher than 17,000 feet. If they could get up to 5,000 feet or 4,000 feet and go make that trek, it would be perfect. So that means they have to have a little bit more sophisticated equipment on there to ballast the helium to set the altitude. It could be done, but, you know, we're talking about $30,000 per craft, and it would take about 100 of these to get us enough information to know what's across that ice.
Well, and then also, like, they probably wouldn't, you would lose your connection with streaming at some point because
you wouldn't be able to stream. You'd just launch them and then
find them at the other
pick end. Them up on the other side. Yeah, there's no radio transmitters. You won't be able to access them until they reach the eastern side.
Okay, all right, that makes sense. Okay, this is super crazy, but like I think that, like, when you went back to the UFO kind of thing, that's what I think. Like, I don't even think we're dealing with aliens from outer space. I think we're dealing with something that's here, currently here. Like, people see repeatedly see like stuff around, and there is a lot of stories of craft going in and out of the water, you know, and there is stories of it, like there's even accounts of people talking about stuff going in and out of mountains as if
flying right into mountains.
I mean, there's all kinds of stuff like that. So it makes me think that, like, that's our aliens. Like, that's what we're dealing with. Then also, like, the pandemic bullshit kind of made me really realize that, if nothing else, there's lockstep about our global power. It's like a one world mafia, right? But then, and then you can get into thinking, oh, it's like corporations or banking systems or this or this or this. But then sometimes I'm going, or maybe it could be ultimately these things that fly these crafts that have some sort of lockstep like thing over. And then so that's why I kind of go, well, maybe they don't want us to come in there. What do you think about that?
I have thoughts about that. I wrote a series of books called The Birth Trilogy, and the book is based upon the idea that there may be advanced beings like Nephilim still here on the earth, and that there aren't many of them, and they have gone to war with man throughout history, and man fights back. We've developed weapons. Even the Romans had weapons called ballistas, which were like cannons that shot a huge dart. It was like a big crossbow. They would wind it up and shoot these iron bolts that weighed about 80 pounds. And they said they were for like knocking down castle walls, but they couldn't do that. They just couldn't do that. But they can punch through the armor of giants. So it makes sense that we have gone to war with them in the past, and it's not been good, not for them or for us. So I think what they've done since the 1700s, I guess, is to work with the leaders of the earth, or to make leaders of the earth and control the world that way. I actually call it the global syndicate. It has four divisions to it: a political, a military, an economic, and now what we call the global media empire, which at one time there were about 60 big companies that ran it. Now there's only 9. So it's very easy for them to control. But you're right, Nikki. I mean, somebody picked up the phone in 2020 and said, lock it up.
Oh, yeah.
And every nation just did
it. And lock it up in the same way. Exactly. Yeah. And then they won't fight it. They'll just do it. They proved me wrong.
Somebody has that kind of power, you know, and look what they did with the Patriot Act. I mean, in 2001, you could walk right up to the gate and say goodbye to your loved ones as they got on the airplane and flew away. And in 2002, you couldn't. That was it. And it wasn't just the U.S. It was everywhere. Everywhere they searched you. All over the world.
During World War II, you didn't even have passports. Most places didn't have passports. You'd go all over the world without a passport. That's not even that. That wasn't even 100 years ago, y'all. Like, that's not that long ago. And when I was like, before 9/11, like, I went to Mexico and Canada with my driver's license. And
absolutely.
Then, like, now that's like such a foreign concept. It's like, what? You did what?
And,
like,
and the kids, will we ever go back? You think we'll ever get our freedom back?
No, once they take it away, you never get it back.
Yeah, exactly. So what was the purpose of locking the whole world down like that?
Yeah,
I'm asking that question. What was the purpose of locking the entire world down?
Yeah, I think about this a lot. Like, so this is where I get away from the human story, because I'm kind of going, there's just not amount of greed, or there's not enough of like one person can consume it all. Mr. Scrooge McDuck, that's like the mastermind of this selfish little person, or it's the red party or the blue party No, like that's where I'm thinking, like, this goes beyond a human egoic one life. Yeah, thing. Like, exactly. Whatever this is longer lived than us.
It goes to the age of a Nephilim, the age of an angel that's here on the earth. I mean, look at the way the earth existed since history was written. One man basically ruled the entire world for hundreds and hundreds, thousands of years. And then in 1776, that changed. We decided to establish a nation that the people ran. And the British, the global syndicate, I call them, they tried to defeat us twice and couldn't do it. Twice. And so rather than fight us from the outside, they decided to infiltrate us and fight us from the inside. And yeah, look what happened.
I also think that, I think this, as much as we can use it as a wonderful, amazing tool, it's also a big weapon. And I think they've been working on us from all angles. I think we're intentionally being dumbed down, you know, through our media, through our propaganda machines, through our food, through our, like, you know, the technology stuff, through all the medical crap or whatever. I think so many people that I interact with are walking zombies, you know?
Yeah. Well, the last time they smashed the economy in this, on this planet was 1933. I mean, they basically collapsed the money supply and everybody went to, you know, 75 cents a day and all the potatoes you could carry home. And slowly the middle class, the free people, started to work their way back. And then in 2008, of course, the mortgage-backed security system took a big hiccup and that broke down. But you look at what happened in 2008 and then in 2012 and then 2016, the planet was changing because the leadership had changed. It became what we call the establishment. It became owned by some foreign, weird, like Nephilim power. Mm. And it didn't matter whether it was red or blue. It was all going in the same direction. And in 2016, they were ready to hand it off to the next ruler. Only that phone you just held up, it changed. From 2012 to 2016, the phone changed. And they missed it. In 2012, phones could not take pictures. You couldn't text. I mean, we were using Blackberries. But in 2012, the iPhone came out and people started to use the tool for their own purposes. And remember, the internet in 1996 is when it got fast. People started using it to learn and to develop their own websites. And they just missed it. The free people of the world started to take that over and they started to communicate their own way on it. And 2016, they thought they were going to win. It was a 98% sure thing. And they didn't win because we were getting our information from another source, that phone. So from 2016 to 2020, they locked all that up. But what happened in 2016 is they lost their leadership. And that leader changed the world. He started an economy of America first, let's call it, but it was every nation first. Every nation was based on liberty at that point, and the world was exploding. No inflation. Everybody was working. Economy was roaring. And I got to tell you, in 2019, I was looking forward to the roaring 20s. I mean, I was really excited about 2020. And then they locked the world down and they smashed.
But then that's what makes me think that it's like this, you know, this came up real fast and this was given to us. I think this is the Tower of Babel and this is going to be taken away from us. Like at some point, I think the internet was created by, like, I think as fast as it was given to us, it can be taken away just as fast like that. Yeah. And then that's going to be a super interesting day when that happens.
We lost control of it. There's no doubt about it. We lost control of it. Now it controls us.
Oh yeah, for sure. It does. And so I don't know. I don't know what's happening, but then like when I go macro, I'm like, okay, so even if it is like other beings, like if it's like, it's called a spiritual war, if you want to call it like alien, whatever you want to call it, something non-human, right? Like do they really want to cull the herd? Is it harvest time? Is it like I don't.
Jupiter ascending?
Yeah, Jupiter ascending kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, like, is that like that sort of situation? Are we talking about like, are we about to go through a pole shift? And it's kind of like, well, like, let's, the resources are going to be scarce after that. So we might, I don't know. None of that really makes sense, you know? So I really, I don't. Well,
it comes around to us. You know, we are the only creatures on this planet that can perceive time. We are creators. We're individual creators. And when we pool our creativity, we become formidable. In the universe, we're formidable. And maybe that Nephilim, that intelligence, is at war with us because they don't want us to be free. They don't want us to be free. They want to control us. They want the energy of our soul.
And maybe it is a pressure cooker. Like, it's kind of like they'll see how far they could push us. And then maybe that's what, you know, makes us like bloom some kind of way.
Be. What would they do if we all turned our phones off?
I really don't know. And like, what would they do if we just like completely created our own monetary systems and our own, like, grew our own food and like totally went, like, became like awesome hobbits. And we're like, chill, we're going to go build a bunch of shires and like,
There are a lot of countries like that, but they got locked up too. They got locked down too. It was like
crazy. I was in Mexico for a large part, or like 3 months during 2020, and they were more militant about the mask than anywhere I've been.
Yeah,
I had to wear it on the beach. Like they had like policemen who would fine you tickets, and like, I mean, you get like walking on the side of the road there. I mean, it was like they wanted you wearing it in your car.
I never would. I wore it to work, but as soon as I hit that front door for the parking lot, I took it off.
Yeah, I'm a flight attendant, and I, like, by the last, I don't know, towards the end of it, I was just actively going, you know, like wearing it like that. And then people would be like, ma'am, he's not wearing his mask. And I'd be like, oh, he isn't? I'll make an announcement. Thanks. Like, I don't know. It there's only so much you can put up with the charade before you just have to.
I know. And the bad thing is that was only part of it. The rest of it was to get the jab out there. And now we've got 128 million Americans walking around with that stuff in their bloodstreams. And we don't know what's going to happen.
We don't know what the fuck it is. I know. And, it, you know, the problem with that, too, is it's like, I don't care if it's a nanobot, like DNA reset, all this crap, or if it literally is just water. And then they're trying to see, like, you know, how much, I don't really care what it is or isn't. Like I understand how World War II happened at this point. Like, I understand, like, the amount of persecution. I mean, like, I mean, personally, it was like from my family, from my friends. I mean, I almost lost my job over that. I mean, like, it was just super, I've never, that was disheartening. And maybe
I rebelled. I found a pharmacy in Japan that would ship ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine to my listeners. So you don't need a prescription. People can go to my website and they can buy ivermectin and HCQ for themselves without a prescription. And I've sent it to over 20,000 people. None of them have gone to the hospital.
Yeah. I mean, I went to Mexico and got a ton of ivermectin and brought it, because it's just over the counter there. It's like, you know, like, okay, whatever. That's just,
it's a 3 milligram tablet, but it still works.
Yeah. I had COVID and it was like, I mean, whatever, but I mean, I'll take this part out. Cause like, I still want to have a YouTube, right? That's the other thing. You know,
yeah. That's the other thing. I lost my YouTube channel.
And that's just
30,000 subscribers, 21 years of content gone, just like that.
Really? They just,
yeah. That's okay. I'm building it on other platforms.
Yeah, you're on Rumble, and are you on Odyssey and BitChute?
Yeah. And on Foxhole and Rockfin, and of course I stream on Facebook and Twitter and DLive. So I stream on all those platforms.
I mean, I think we'll eventually have to diversify like that anyway. Like, and I mean, and
decentralize everything.
Yeah, and it sucks that, I mean, I know that had to be a blow, but at least it's, you know, it's kind of like you get to see who you're. I mean, at least it shows it to you now.
Yeah.
So how many false hope?
And then later. You know, PayPal, they stole $3,000 plus from me and shut me off. That was 21 years of banking gone. And then Shopify got me for about 1500 and banned me for life. So you find other ways. You just find other ways.
Yeah, I know Patreon has done that. Like I know one guy I follow, his Patreon got taken away. Just, you know. So yeah, and that's another thing is it's like, you know, I had this conversation with a friend the other day who was talking about like, yeah, but I don't really think anybody should just be allowed to say whatever they want. Like Kanye, he was talking about like Kanye West or whatever. And I was like, whoa. Let's talk about free speech. Like you should be able to say whatever you want, even if it's the most heinous, horrible thing in the world. Or yes, there's fire in a theater that there's not fire. Because the thing is like how we grow, we literally talk and have conversation. You're not going to change some whatever, like crazy racist person or something, or what, it doesn't matter what the thing is. You're not going to change their mind by silencing them. You're only like, if you really wanted to change their mind, you would have a, like an actual debate with them. Like you would have a conversation. We would talk it out. You would see even the most dissenting view on anything.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They call it disinformation, or you're harmful to their community. And so
that's the thing. There shouldn't be such thing as disinformation. Like that's, I don't know, whatever. Like there's,
I never heard of disinformation. I mean, it's information.
It may not just be your information that, yeah, so this right there is, for me, this goes way beyond the pay grade of our current governments that are doing this. Like something is actively, very, very, and it's even to a point where they have, I'll give you a perfect example. Yesterday on Twitter, I reposted this guy talking about how, you know, it's a misnomer that they're fossil fuels. It should be like, you know, because it's actually like
natural fuels.
It's accretion of the earth. Okay. It's not from dead organic matter from millions of years ago.
Yeah.
And that's something that I even learned in geology, like when I was in university. That's something that if you're studying it in depth, you like that's not like a, so then I got a bunch of bots basically talking to me about climate change, being a climate change denier, and like about how that was misinformation, and that even if it isn't fossil fuels, like it still is a finite resource that we're going to be out of in 2 years by now. All this like stuff.
200 and I'm going, years maybe.
And I'm kind of going like, wow, like you. People, that's like something is on a story, like,
oh yeah,
big time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously if you discover oil and then the federal government comes in and says, okay, that's now federal land, and then the federal government then says, well, you can't pump oil on this land anymore, and so they turn off the oil, eventually you run out.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And that's what we've done. I mean, oh yeah, don't get me started on that.
Again, it's the global syndicate, and what they do is they infiltrate the agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations, and they write regulations that basically hand the world over to a small number of global corporations, and they rule the world. But it's been that way for 1,000 years.
Yeah. So what do you think it is? Like, what do you think what do you think is the global, like, what do you think that it is?
Climate change?
How about this? Can you just give me like, as like our final sort of like thing, give me your overall, as you stand right now, what's your big picture of what's really going on?
As far as climate?
Well, as far as like, you know, connected to the global syndicate and the inner earth. And it maybe that doesn't go into it with you or not, but the control system of the planet. What do you think?
I think that there is a battle between light and darkness. And I think that the dark forces of the earth have been in control of this planet for 2,000 years. And whenever there's a rebellion or a people that break free, and they become autonomous or powerful, that dark force is going to go to war with them. If it takes 100 years, they will bring them back in line. And I would say, based upon the winners and losers that are happening right now today, they're pretty close to recapturing the entire world. I mean, really, all they have to do is do away with money and go to a digital currency and then link that currency to your social score, just like they do your YouTube channel. And you're pretty much done, unless you're going to grow your own garden and raise your own rabbits. You're pretty much done. You have to comply. So they're very close to recapturing the world. And I think that darkness is real. I think that there are dark forces on this earth, as there are all around the universe. And I think that that they're trying to defeat us.
And so kind of like a spiritual, you think it's like a spiritual war still in a
good way? I think it's a spiritual war because we're eternal beings having a mortal experience. We are ancient. Each one of us, if we could just remember who we are, we would realize that. You know, as well as I do, there are very old souls. You've met some. You probably are one. And there are some souls that are just so young, they'll buy into anything. Because we see them all the time. They're like zombies. They don't have a mind of their own. They're blown around by every wind of doctrine. But there is a significant number of us who are awake, and we live in a constant state of amazement.
Well, that's very, very true. Well, I like that a lot, Mr. Brooks. Okay, this has been super fun.
You too. I've enjoyed it.
And thank you so much for coming on. Yeah, and like let me know if you ever want to come on again and talk about, like, if we could try to get any funding for the expedition. Like, you know, got to get it all different directions.
Oh, we could talk about new energy. We could talk about all kinds of things.
Ooh, I love free energy and all that kind of good stuff. Okay, cool. So, and tell us real quick where people can find you.
The easiest way is to go to brooksagnew.com. It's so simple. Just go there. Everything is linked there. My radio program, my store is there. You can find out about my books, my public appearances, all my TV shows and all that. You can find everything right there. It's so simple. And you can communicate with me with a contact form right there on that site. I monitor it all day and I write everybody back.
That's how I got a hold of you.
That's right.
All right. That sounds awesome. Well, we will have you back on at some point. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Nikki. Ha, ha, ha.